I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Utah's best athletes count on flexibility, speed, strength.
And the Jazz pick up their 22nd assist.
So they count on University of Utah Health.
Brielle Soleil puts this game away.
And so can you. Leading doctors, a world-class environment, award-winning innovation, care to be great.
14 unanswered by the Utes.
University of Utah Health, caring for Utah's best and yours. Schedule your appointment now at uofuhealth.org/care to be great.
Welcome into the Jazz Notes Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Anderson. Very happy Friday, day before Halloween, October 30th. I am recording this. Appreciate you tuning in. As always, you can read me at kslsports.com. If you haven't done it yet, it's really easy to do. Open your app store, download the KSL Sports app. That's the KSL Sports app. Just search for it. Apple, Android, whatever you have, you can find it in the App Store. It's really cool, super easy to use, and actually makes listening to this podcast super easy as well. So make sure you do that, the KSL Sports app, if you would. Appreciate that. Also, we have a new newsletter coming out. Actually, the easiest way to sign up for that right now, if you're curious in getting the newsletter, go to the KSL Sports app or kslsports.com. I have an article out. I've tweeted it out at Ben's Hoops, at KSL Sports on Twitter. Where you can rank the best Jazz nicknames in NBA history. When you vote, it'll give you the opportunity to sign up for the newsletter. You just throw in your email, that's it, and then you can get kind of the biggest stories in the state of Utah emailed to you with the newsletter. So really cool expanding that way as well. KSL Sports is doing some fantastic things, but really starts with the app and then get into the newsletter from there if you're interested. Big show today. Ryan Smith buying the Jazz from the Millers. We'll talk about that, obviously. We'll talk about Ryan Smith a little bit, what I know about him. Draft prospects, four guys, three international, one kid, a point guard from Alabama, Kyra Lewis, we'll talk about him. The facilities are reopening by the NBA. I'll tell you what I think that means. Negotiations for next season, what that looks like, when it's going to start, what the rest of the offseason is going to look like. We'll talk about that. And then, as I always do, I'm going to finish the podcast by answering your mailbag questions. All right, again, find me on Twitter at Ben's Hoops if you do want to submit mailbag questions to me. Big news broke, man, what was it, Wednesday, that Gail Miller and the Miller family were selling the Utah Jazz a majority share, according to Tony Jones of The Athletic, 80% of the team to Ryan Smith, the CEO of Qualtrics. Ryan had apparently been interested in buying RSL. A rumor I had heard was he was talking about kind of buying RSL with the Jazz. They would kind of share ownership and management responsibilities. I don't know if that ever got off the ground. Obviously, RSL hasn't sold yet. But there were conversations along those lines a little bit, it sounded like. And whatever happened, he ended up buying the Jazz. $1.6 billion deal. Gets Vivint Smart Home Arena, or just Vivint Arena now. Gets the Stars. Gets management role over the Bees, though the Millers will retain ownership of the Bees, which is kind of an interesting deal as well. I'm sure that has something to do with Major League Baseball, ownership, selling teams. I'm sure it just gets difficult, and maybe it was easier to do that. So the Millers had a huge legacy on the Jazz. I wrote an article about their legacy. I mentioned kind of the steadiness that they brought to a team. It took a lot of guts to buy the Jazz when they did in the 80s, where they were not financially solvent. They were not in a good spot, which is why Sam Battistone was selling them. Larry H. Miller and Gail took a huge risk by buying them. spent about $25 to $30 million in total over 2 years to get the team. It just happened to coincide with John Stockton and Karl Malone coming into their own. You can't ask for much better luck than having two of the, 30 best players to ever put on an NBA uniform on your roster as you're buying a team, because the Jazz went on that amazing tear. But even through that, where Karl Malone and Larry had their spats very publicly, they continued to show that better side, their willingness to let things play out. And it put the Jazz in a situation where they are now as one of the most successful small franchises in all of professional sports in the United States. They're competitive every year for the playoffs. They make the playoffs most years. I want to say over the 35 years that the Millers had it, 30 of those years they had a record of 500 or better, and they made the playoffs 27 of those 35. I mean, you think of some of these teams like the Sacramento Kings, who haven't seen the playoffs in, it was like 18 years. I mean, just something absolutely ridiculous. Not quite that long, but, you know, an eternity now since they've been to the playoffs. And to think that the Jazz basically just never miss the playoffs. And when they do, it's very much by design of, hey, we're going to start over on this rebuild. We're going to get back within a couple of years to be in a playoff spot. And it's worked basically every time they've done that. They've really not had major delays or issues as they've been building their team. Now, they don't always reach the championship level. Of course, they haven't yet. But I think the fact that the Millers were able to have those types of plans and execute them so well and trust the people in charge to do their jobs to get them there is a real testament to the legacy that they have. And I think if I'm a Jazz fan, that's what I would hope Ryan Smith is able to take from the Millers, that sometimes the best thing you can do is to get out of the way, trust that the organization has an ability to fix itself somewhat because you have the right people in place. The nice thing about where the Jazz are right now, as opposed to what Tillman Fertitta has basically done in Houston, what some ownership groups do when they have to take over, which is what happened when Ballmer bought the Los Angeles Clippers, is you have to come in and you have to replace a bunch of things. Now, Ballmer didn't have to come in and replace Doc Rivers. You know, that ended up happening down the line a little bit. But, you know, they got rid of Chris Paul. They lost DeAndre Jordan. They lost Blake Griffin. Like, they made all these crazy changes because of how toxic the culture was and how bad the ownership was. And not those players specifically, but just, it was such a radical change, they had to make major moves. And they did, and now the Clippers are fine, but they've had to undergo several years and a bunch of blockbuster trades and gave up a ton of draft capital to kind of get into this spot, and then they still had issues in the playoffs. The Jazz aren't in this spot where they have to radically fix anything. The Millers were great owners, so Ryan Smith now steps in and inherits a good product, a very well-functioning machine that should continue to work. You have a great general manager in Justin Zanuck, a great vice president of basketball operations in Dennis Lindsay, a fantastic coach in Quinn Snyder, super talent at Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, plus Bojan Bogdanovic and Mike Conley. You're going to have some major contract issues you got to figure out that we've talked about on prior podcasts. That's, of course, what to do with Rudy Gobert and a potential supermax contract he's got looming in the next 8 months. Donovan Mitchell's got a max contract. I imagine the Jazz are going to offer that the day that free agency window opens. You got to figure out what to do with Jordan Clarkson. Mike Conley could potentially opt out. It doesn't sound like he's going to, but you could try and rework his contract. You've got the mid-level exception, the biannual exception. You've got big decisions, basically, on Ryan Smith's first day. And I know he's not going to own the team until probably the end of the year, but obviously he's going to have the say in what the Jazz are doing. They're going to consult him on how he wants to spend his money, what they want the future of this team to look like. And he's got to make all those decisions very, very quickly. And I would imagine as he was buying the team, he was already meeting with Dennis Lindsay and Justin Zanuck about plans on what to do with the roster, on plans on how you want this thing to look 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, how comfortable you are spending money, where you want the salary cap to be. Are you willing to go into the luxury tax to build a contender? Those are all questions I'm sure you have to kind of knock out really quickly, especially as the Jazz are developing the strategy. So really interesting there. I don't know if Ryan Smith's going to be willing to go into the luxury tax. I don't know how much he's worth. I'm sure those numbers will come out a little bit more clearly. Forbes says he's at $1.3 billion right now, but he just bought a team for $1.6 billion. I know he sold his company, Qualtrics, where he still works, where he's still the CEO, for $8 billion. I don't know if he was $2 billion in debt for building that enormous building that's on the east side of I-15. Once you get out to Silicon Slopes, I don't know if that cost him a bunch of money, and he sold the company and paid that off, and that was, you know, 25%, 30% of his earnings, and then he lost a bunch of it to taxes. Like, I could see very well how he made $7 billion, and then half of it's gone to taxes, and then another $2 million was due to debt that the company was operating with, and then he has a $1.5 billion left over. Like, I get how that could work. It wouldn't be surprising to me. But also, I'm not, you know, a tax shelter haven genius. I don't know how to do that stuff. So maybe he does have $4 billion and he bought the Jazz cash and he's got $3.5 billion he wants to play with, or $2.5 billion he's comfortable playing with and just wants to build a contender. Like, those are things that we still have to learn and that will develop. And we will actually probably understand a lot of those based on the decisions he makes with the Jazz over the next couple of months. He can't build this team into a contender really beyond what they are right now as is, and with the tools the Jazz have this offseason, because I don't anticipate them making any significant trades, nor do I see potential trades out there that could put the Jazz in that contender status immediately as a favorite. There's not a Paul George available. Well, okay, Paul George probably is available. There's not a LeBron James available. Kevin Durant's not available. Kawhi Leonard's not available, and the Jazz aren't getting those pieces. So you don't jump to the top of the contender status right away just because Ryan Smith took over, but we'll get a sense of his aggression, spending money, what the salary cap allows, and we'll talk about that coming up in just a moment, to see what his approach is. And that's going to be fun to watch. That's going to be a new culture for the Jazz. And look, I'm a sports fan too. You probably know I used to host a radio show a lot. I've never understood why fans care about teams' money so much. Like, you don't want your team to go broke and have to sell. That's bad. But as long as teams are willing to kind of spend money and have fun, I don't care if they're making money or not. That's never bothered me. I don't care if a college team makes money. I don't care if a basketball team makes money or loses money. I want to see them win games. So Jazz fans, you should be happy. And one of the fun things, it's why college is great. It's why I love the draft. Turnover is fun. Like, stability's great. You need to have it. But a shakeup to the status quo was really fun. I think this is going to be a fun story if you're a Jazz fan to watch this. I'm excited to write about it. I'm excited to figure out kind of how the chess game is being played differently with Ryan Smith, because it's going to. So that's going to be fun to watch. So I that's obviously the huge news, exciting news. I think he's the right owner. I think it's smart to have one voice that's consolidated again. Larry H. Miller was great at doing that. Gail did a fantastic job when she took over in 2009. Of having one solid voice. It wasn't split between five people trying to make decisions. There weren't too many cooks in the kitchen. She was the voice. And I think one of the reasons, my guess, is the motivation to sell the team now and take it out of the family legacy trust that had been set up was that finally there was one person that could have one voice and one vision that could buy the team outright without a group investment and wanted to handle it that way, and felt like he was the right guy to make the decisions. And they said, this is better than keeping it in a trust. We're going to have to make decisions on the team. It might just be a burden to own a professional team. I'm sure it is. And it may have not been one that the kids wanted to have. So good for Ryan Smith for buying the team. I think it's going to be a good move ultimately, but we have to sit and watch that play out. All right. Now, if you've been following my coverage, and I hope you have, at KSL Sports or on the KSL Sports app, you see I'm doing a write up at least every other day. Usually I got a little bit derailed just because of all the crazy news this week with the Millers selling the team, but about draft prospects, because the November 18th draft is very quickly approaching. Jazz have the 23rd pick. They don't have a second round pick. So I've been looking at guys projected to go in that range, generally about 20 on most mock drafts, down to about 40, because there's actually quite a bit of wiggle room. This is a really strong draft where the Jazz are selecting. You're going to get a good player, or at least you have the opportunity to get a good player. So I've been breaking down a lot of these names. I did four guys this week. I cheated a little bit because I did three European players on one article, and I'll explain why I did that. It's already hard to find game film, full games of college basketball. And I like to watch full games because I want to see what a guy's doing when he's defending off the ball. I want to see what a guy's doing when he's not touching the ball in the offense. I want to see what happens when he doesn't touch it three possessions in a row, or does he demand that he touches it three possessions in a row. I want to see body language. I want to see all of those things, because if you just watch highlights, obviously you're going to get skewed for the best and the worst. Or if you just watch, kind of individualized plays pulled out, it's going to tell you whatever you want to interpret. Watching the full games, I think gives you a big sense of, hey, when do they show up? When do they disappear? What do they do well that maybe doesn't show up on a highlight film? Those are all things that I really care about and I think are probably more important to the draft conversation than most outlets like to look at. So I really like to put the time in. It's hard to do it this year with college players because there was no March Madness, there was no tournament, which is where a lot of those full games end up getting recorded and uploaded, and I record them on a DVR, and a lot of those were gone this year. We just didn't have it, so it was hard to do. European games are equally difficult to find and maybe even more difficult to find online if you're just trying to stream a game. You know, NCAA basketball, the NCAA actually uploads some of their full games that have their best prospects on YouTube and you can watch them. You can't always find that with European games. So it gets hard to find some of these. And then a lot of these guys play 2 or 3 minutes for their rosters because they're, you know, 19 and just signing with their major league rosters for the first time in Europe. So it gets really hard to watch them. So scouting the European players, I did something I don't like to do. I watched as much highlight footage as I could, plus the lowlights. I tried to break them down that way. I read everything I could about them to give you a breakdown. So I'll knock out those three guys really quick, and then we can come back and talk a little bit about Kyra Lewis from Alabama. So the first guys to talk about, and we'll talk about him because I know the Jazz have already interviewed him, is Theo Maledon from France, 6'4", 175-pound guard, 19 years old. Averaged 7 points, just about 2 rebounds, 3 assists, shot 45% from the floor, 36% from the three-point line, under 70% from the free throw line, but that was kind of all over throughout his professional career so far. He's a better free throw shooter than 68%. Really good passer in the pick and roll, not kind of your floor general point guard the way a Cassius Winston from Michigan State is going to be this year, but maybe a little bit more of kind of the modern style of point guard. Doesn't get sped up ever with the ball in his hand. Plays at a very slow pace. Now, that's a good and a bad thing. You know, Nikola Jokic doesn't get sped up either, but it's because he says he can't play fast, so he had to learn how to play slow. Maledon kind of had to do the same thing. He's not a very quick player. He's not going to burst up and down the floor in transition, but he's super under control all the time. A little bit more like a Michael Carter Williams, I want to say, but I don't want you to think he's that poor of a shooter or plays that style of game. He plays a little slow. He's got a little bit more pace like that, just to give you one comparison off the top of my head. 36% of his three-pointers going down. That's a good sign. You like to see that. 6'8" wingspan. That's nice to see. He's good finishing at the rim, out of the pick and roll especially. I get it. I get why he's a prospect. Good size for a point guard. I think if he played in the college level, he'd probably be projected a little bit higher than he is right now, which is end of the first round, early second. But he has some weaknesses as well, as they always do. As I say, he plays a little bit slower. That might be difficult to do at the NBA level because if they want to speed you up, if your defenders want to get into you, that could be tough. And if you can't score off the dribble as a guard, it becomes really hard to play you for extended periods of time. So he's going to have to do that, and he's going to have to learn how to do it by getting separation off the dribble without having speed, which is hard to do in the modern NBA. You think a lot of the guys who can score right now, you know, Donovan Mitchell's first step is ridiculous. Dame's first step is ridiculous. James Harden plays with a lot of pace. He's not as quick, but he's still really fast. So it's hard to think you're going to be able to score in the NBA when you're not running super quick, especially if you're not a fantastic shooter. And Maledon's not a fantastic shooter. So those are going to be some of the issues he's going to deal with. He's got great length, but he's not a great defensive player. That's a little bit of a red flag for me. If you're going to be long, you should probably be a good defender, and he's not. He kind of gets burned a lot. That, again, goes back to his low athleticism. He kind of looks lackadaisical at times, but it picks up in close games. He's interesting. He's not my favorite prospect. He's not a guy I would love if I was a Jazz fan if they picked him up at 23. I think there's better options on the board. Leandro Balmaro, also kind of a guard forward, 6'7", 180 pounds, only 19. Just signed with FC Barcelona, so he's actually a draft and stash player, but he has an out after this season, so he could come in as soon as the 2021-2022 season. He's got maybe the most fun highlights I've ever watched in my life from a European player. He's crazy with the ball in his hands, great dribble moves, attacks off the dribble, runs the court, throws unbelievably crazy passes, I mean, super highlight reel passes, pretty consistently. He's a little bit wild, but he's fun to watch. I mean, he's a really cool player. He's a player who if you got him at 23 and he developed into what his potential is, he ends up being the steal of the draft. I mean, he's kind of got that super high upside because of the things he can do with the ball in his hand. Really good distributor. He's a good defensive player. Like, he can really get up into guys because he moves so well, because he's so athletic. But he cannot shoot a lick. Like, it's insane how bad of a shooter he is for his size, considering he's playing against other guys who aren't as big in Europe as they will be in the NBA. And he's probably going to have to be a little bit more perimeter-oriented. 42% from the floor, despite his great athleticism and ability to get the rim. He should just shoot better than that. And then just 29% from the three-point line during the 2018-2019 season. Well, 29% is horrendous. It's awful. It's unusable. Now, he only played a few games with FC Barcelona this year, but those percentages dipped to 21% from the floor and 9% from the three-point line. Like, that's, you can't be on the basketball court. You just absolutely can't play at all. The worst shooters in the NBA are 28% from the three-point line and have to do other things so unbelievably well to get on the floor. It becomes really hard to play him. So his whole thing is he's got to prove he can shoot after you draft him and stash him in Europe, and then hope that if he learns to shoot, he's willing to come over, and if he doesn't, he's still willing to come over and you're willing to work with him on it. There's a little bit of a gamble there, but he's super high upside. He's pretty fun to watch. And then Yam Madar, 6'3", 180-pound guard, more of a point guard. Gets some kind of funny comparisons. I saw Javon Carter. I saw Patrick Beverley. Super aggressive with the ball in his hands. Like, plays, do you remember watching Deron Williams tried to really dribble the ball hard? Like, it looked like he was trying to poke a hole in the floor with his hard dribble, but a really good crossover, gets into the paint just like Deron Williams used to. Doesn't have that same body, he's much skinnier, but kind of his aggressive style of play really reminded me of Deron Williams when I was watching him. He just doesn't have the strength. Good handles, really good crossover, has a good mid-range shot, gets to the rim and finishes really well. And then the reason you hear the Javon Carter or the Patrick Beverley comparisons is because he'll really get into you on the defensive end. Likes to get right up on guys, does it from 94 feet, just hounds you the whole way. And that's cool. There's a reason you don't see it in the NBA, because it doesn't work that well, because the ball handlers are just too good. Yeah, you might pick their pocket once or twice a game if you're willing to do that, and you can do it for 36 minutes, but really takes away your energy on the offensive side of the ball. But it also puts you in foul trouble pretty regularly. It allows you to get burned off the dribble because you're playing too close. He kind of has that guy. He plays so hard that he makes mistakes. He needs to figure out that balance and that even level to really find his game to work at the NBA level. Against 19-year-olds and 18-year-olds in Europe at the lower levels, yeah, he's going to torch those kids that don't ever have a chance to make it to the NBA. He's not going to do that against the best players in the world. He's not going to be able to do that against Donovan Mitchell or Chris Paul or basically any guard in the league. He'll have moments, but he's got to tone it down a little bit. He's got to dial it back. He's also not a great three-point shooter, just 27%. That's not good enough. That's going to have to develop as well. Otherwise, he's looking as a kind of potential as a backup guard. And I think when you're looking at the guards in this draft, especially that are available at 23, there's probably better options. And in fact, I would tell you already, of the international players I've talked about, Theo Maledon's probably a better prospect from Europe of those three guys. So I broke him down. I broke those three guys down. You can read that. I also talked a little bit about Kyra Lewis. I broke him down. He got his own individual write-up. He's the point guard from Alabama. 6'3", 165 pounds. That's what he was reported as leaving college. That number's jumped up now, apparently, to 180 pounds. I saw that yesterday, just because he's been in the weight room since March and trying to get bigger, which he's going to have to do. Super speed. Think De'Aaron Fox with his ability to put the ball in his hands and get rim to rim. I mean, baseline to baseline. He's incredibly quick. Doesn't waste steps in transition, nice long stride, so he gets where he wants to quickly, really comfortable moving that fast with the ball in his hands, which is important. You know, Dante Exum was insanely quick, he couldn't dribble, so it didn't matter how fast he was, he had to slow down, and then he gave up his advantage. That was a problem with Dante. Kyra Lewis doesn't seem to have that problem. He's a much more adept ball handler than Donovan was. So when you think of De'Aaron Fox, Dennis Schroeder, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Lou Williams, some of these guys who are really speedy and kind of have those frames, those kind of like boxy DeJounte Murray, big shoulders, thin waist frames, that's what Kyra Lewis looks like. So there's kind of a blueprint for guys in the NBA who have made it who look like him. You can decide how fantastic those guys are. De'Aaron Fox is really good. Dennis Schroeder's pretty good. DeJounte Murray is probably kind of your starting average point guard right now. That might be what you're getting with Kyrie Lewis. If you get a starting point guard at 23, you're really happy, especially because at 6'3", he can probably team a little bit next to Donovan Mitchell in some lineups. I think that's what's really interesting about him and fun to watch. He's got good footwork. He jumps really well once he gets into the paint. He's not really a dunker, especially in the half court. You don't see that a ton, but he can certainly finish at the rim, and that's intriguing. Intriguing, or I guess, you know, kind of passable shooter at this point, 36% from the three-point line, 44% from the floor. Like, he doesn't look to me like he's ever going to be a crazy good three-point shooter. I would be surprised if he gets over 40%, but if he can stay around 37, 36%, I think he could be in a really good spot. Average two steals a game. He's really young. He reclassified out of high school from his junior year up to being a freshman in college, where he played 2 years at Alabama. So he comes in like a freshman in age, but like a sophomore in experience. So that's good. He's going to be more ready to contribute early. And the way Alabama plays looks like an NBA team. They space the floor, they take a ton of threes, and they play at a really high pace. Most colleges don't do that, so the speed of the game is a tough adjustment for college kids. It will be less so because of his natural gifts and because of the style of play he had while he was at Alabama. So that's good. 180 pounds is still skinny. He's going to have to put on a bunch of weight before he can play defenses. Opposing defenses are going to attack his dribble. They're going to force him to make decisions, essentially, because he's not a great passer, which is a little troublesome as a point guard. He gets in the paint because he's so quick and because he can handle the ball, but then they're going to collapse on him and say, can you find an open shooter? Can you find the roll man? Can you find some of those short roll things? There are issues with his vision and playing next to other good guards at Alabama that kind of handled some of those point guard responsibilities, even though his assist numbers were really good. So there's clearly some potential there. He averaged 5 assists a game, despite not really having great vision. So there's still some upside there to develop as well. His raw natural talents get him, find success for him, help him find success on the floor. So he's intriguing. I get why he's there at 23. I get why he's not projected to go 12. Some mocks really like him. Some have him in the top 15. I would be surprised if that's the case. I just don't think he's quite that developed compared to some of the other guys in the draft. But he brings a bunch of speed. The Jazz don't have a ton of speed right now. They could probably use that at the guard position. He's intriguing. I don't like him as much as Trey Jones. I actually don't even like him as much as Cassius Stanley, though he's got a much better, or Cassius Winston, excuse me. But he's got a much better frame than those guys. Trey Jones certainly isn't bad. He's not my favorite prospect at 23. I'll release a list as we get closer to the draft of kind of what my big board would be, who I like the most of these guys. I'm sure you can tell that I like Trey Jones quite a bit because I bring him up a lot. I also think he's the guy most likely the Jazz are going to draft, and I talked about him on the last podcast if you want to go back and find that. But tons of breakdowns on the draft. That's what I did this week. I also have Cole Anthony, Desmond Bain, Jalen Smith, Xavier Tillman, Cassius Winston, Sam Merrill, Yoli Childs, and Isaiah Stewart and Jaden McDaniels. So I've got a bunch of breakdowns done and a bunch more to go. So appreciate you sticking with me through those breakdowns. Give them a read. Gives you a quick update on not only what their strengths and weaknesses are, but more importantly, how they'll fit with the Jazz, which fit matters. Quick NBA news today that broke. The facilities are reopening, so the Jazz could open the Zions Bank Basketball Center to the players if they want to come in and do off-season workouts. They're doing that to make sure the guys aren't going to the gym, and where we're having such massive spread of coronavirus all over the country, I think they want to make sure guys can come in and work in a safe environment. If they are going to come in, they have to get tested. That's another thing the NBA wants. They don't want their guys getting sick. They don't want guys missing time in the future. They don't want guys having long-term serious issues. So if you want to come back and go to your host city where your team plays and play in the facility, you can have 10 other guys there, or 10 guys total of your players, so you could get some pretty good runs going. The NBA wants to control the virus, make sure guys aren't getting sick and spreading it to each other, and then also make sure these guys are kind of in shape, make sure these guys are in a good place where if the season has to start very quickly, which has kind of been the rumor that it could start as soon as December 22nd, they're ready to go. They're already in shape. They're already around their teams. They've already been undergoing testing, so they're not going to be pushed back an additional 2 weeks. I think that's the big reason why they're wanting to do this right now. And it makes sense. It also is tied into the fact that negotiations for when the season is supposed to start, when free agency is supposed to start, which was supposed to be decided today, have been pushed back into next week. That's good. At least they're not walking away from the table. You don't want a lockout. But they clearly haven't come to an agreement. Michelle Roberts, who's the executive director of the Players Association today, said the players thought it was kind of a wildly outrageous that the NBA wanted the season to start on the 22nd of December with training camps opening on December 1st. They just said that was too unrealistic. NBA players want Martin Luther King Day on January 18th. They will figure it out. I suspect we will see games on Christmas. That's just what my gut tells me. There's so much money on the table to do it. It might not be LeBron. It might not be the showcase they want, but it would be cool to have Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving make their debut. It would be cool to have Steph Curry and Klay Thompson back with the Warriors. Like, even if you can only get two games or three games on Christmas, and then you slowly start the season and hope by January 1st, 2nd, everyone's playing, maybe you have to do that. But you give those teams who haven't played in a while, haven't played since March, an opportunity to get out there and get some games under their belt. And maybe if you're a team that's willing to play early and players that are willing to play early, you get extra rest throughout the season. And the teams that aren't ready to start early and want to start a little bit later into January, you know, maybe the first week, second week of January, they just get fewer days off and they get more back-to-backs, or they have to play a back-to-back-to-back at some point, if not two. Those are things that could be on the table for the NBA. So we will keep an eye on that. Hopefully a week from now, we'll have a better understanding of when the season's going to start. So that's what I wrote about this week at KSL Sports and on the KSL Sports app. You can go and read all of those articles. I appreciate you doing that. If you would, always helps us out. And downloading the app, it's cool. It really is very helpful. It works very well. So what I like to do at this point, as I mentioned, I like to answer your mailbag questions. You can send them to me at Ben's Hoops. You can send them to me throughout the week. I generally like to post that I'm recording on a Friday, have you respond right there, so I kind of have them all focused in one spot. But if you want to DM me, my DMs are open. I usually respond to your DMs that way as well. So I appreciate it. Derek Peterson on Twitter said, seems like the new cap news means that draft picks should be double in value intrinsically because you are getting a cheaper, lower cap hit player long term. Do you think that changes some of the Jazz and the NBA and the NBA's thinking? I don't know if it changes it, because I think that's kind of always been the case. But yes, if the salary cap is coming down, what are they saying, $109 million right now? If the salary cap is coming down and you have these kind of cost-controlled contracts that are pretty low, especially with the Jazz are drafting, their first-round pick's going to make, like $1.5 million or something, and then be on a cost-controlled deal for the next 4 to 7 years, you're in a really good spot. So yes, I think it probably increases the value a little bit. I think the Jazz would love to get another second-round pick, especially if they could get an early second-round pick. Last year, my understanding was they were trying to trade up to get a second-round pick. I think Carson Edwards, who ended up at Boston, was the target. I'm not positive on that, but that's kind of what I've heard. So the Jazz could look at doing that. They could look at kind of finding another player like that if they like that style of play. There are guys like that in the draft. Terrell Terry at Stanford is actually kind of a Carson Edwards clone a little bit, has some similar great shooting stuff, pretty quick with a dribble in his hands. They could look to add another second-round pick. I've kind of thought that maybe they'll look at trading Ed Davis, trying to get that $5 million off the books, and then get a second-round pick in return. And have some cost-controlled deals that way. I don't know what they want to do with their two-way guys. I would suspect Jarrell Brantley comes back next year. I don't know what to make of Justin Wright Foreman at this point. I would be a little surprised, I guess, if he came back, in my opinion. Derek follows up. Another cap question. Seems like there was a lot of smoke for trades and free agent signings. Now the cap looms large and the quick turnaround. Do you think the offseason moves quiet down? I think they do. I think what happens is free agency movement takes a real hit. Maybe we see some more trades, because that becomes the easiest way to make a deal if you don't feel like you're confident you're going to be able to get a meeting with the free agent if there's only a week open window or a 2 week open window before training camp starts. So draft night might be awesome. Draft night might be crazy, where everyone just says, hey, we don't think we're going to get a meeting with Mo Harkless, and we want to make sure we get a 3-and-D forward, so we're going to go trade for a guy, and we're willing to give up picks or swap picks to get there. I could see that type of thing happening. Trade saying, hey, we control our own destiny, versus this two-week gold rush that is going to happen where people are just trying to sign anyone they can because they want to make sure their rosters are full. So yeah, Derek, I think that's a good question, and I think that's probably what's going to happen. Following along on Twitter, which guards do you think are most likely to drop and be available for the Jazz at 23? If you were to choose between Jaden McDaniels, Alexei Pokuševski, which would you choose for the Jazz and why? Guards that are going to be available, I've talked about a lot of them. I think Trey Jones will be there at 23. There's been rumors today I saw that Miami's interested in Ashton Hagans, who isn't even on most mock drafts, but he's kind of a... And I'll tell you why I bring up Miami. Ashton Hagans is probably the best defensive guard in the draft. He's probably right along there. He's just kind of a freak defensively. But Miami's been linked to Trey Jones at 20. Well, if they feel like they can get that defense that Trey Jones brings in Ashton Hagans some point in the second round, they can pass on Trey Jones, and then he slips to 23 for the Jazz. Some people have Trey Jones at 40. Some people really don't like him. I do like him. Cassius Winston, who I mentioned, I think will be there. He should almost definitely be there. A lot of teams seem to think he has a chance to be a steal. I agree. He's a fantastic pick-and-roll player. He kind of reminds me of Kyle Lowry a little bit. He's just a bully. He's got a big body. He's fun to watch. He's not very tall, but he's a tough guy. So I really like him as well. Kyra Lewis could be there. Any of those three guards I mentioned today could be there earlier. Nico Mannion will be there at 23. I'd be stunned if he's not. And there's kind of some interest there, I would think, with the Jazz, just because his dad played for the University of Utah, played in Utah. I don't love Nico, but I could see how he develops. He has a pretty looking shot. It doesn't go in a great amount yet, but he's got a good pull up three. Really can see the floor. Struggled with the lack of spacing in college. I think that's probably what it was, because he got to the paint more in high school. But if he can't get to the paint, he's probably a backup guard. And then you've got, you know, Howell Neto. And I don't know if you want to draft him at 23, even though I love Howell. So a bunch of names. A bunch of guards are going to drop there. I don't think it's going to be Sadiq Bey. I don't think it's going to be some of these other names that have been mentioned. But those are probably the guards that I would talk about. There's going to be a bunch of them. Jazz are going to have their pick. Caleb Manser. Oh, and then getting back to Jaden McDaniels and Alexei Pokuševski. I don't think Pokuševski is going to be there. You don't find guys that are 7 feet tall that shoot that fluidly, even though, again, they don't go in a ton either, or move as fluidly as he does. I bet he ends up going in the lottery. Jaden McDaniels could also be gone by the time the Jazz are picking, because I bet you he looks awesome in workouts, because he's 6'9 and handles the ball and has a pretty shot, but he kind of disappeared during games. But I love Jaden McDaniels. If he was there at 23 and the Jazz drafted him, I think he'd be really fun to watch. Caleb Manser, would you rather put Donovan Mitchell on the old Jazz teams led by D-Will? I love questions like this. And Boozer, or put Mehmet Okur on the current Jazz team? The Jazz might have been the second best team in the NBA with Deron Williams, Carlos Boozer, and Mehmet Okur, and Andre Kirilenko. And Kyle Korver was really good on that team too, but putting Donovan on that team and having another 20-point-per-game scorer, though they didn't really have that style of player so much at that time, would be really incredible. Jazz might have been the best team in the NBA if they had that. But remember, their problem was length. They couldn't match up with Pau, Gasol, and the Lakers' length. And obviously Kobe. Spurs were also fantastic, too. So maybe the Jazz were the third best team. They may have been better than the Lakers on some of those runs, actually, in those early 2000s after Shaq left. Jazz were probably better than the Lakers. Jazz struggled with the Spurs. But then if you add Memo to this team, I'm going to go with Donovan Mitchell to the Deron Williams teams, because I think the Jazz were closer to being the best team in the league, and Donovan could have maybe put them over the top. Memo on this team is basically a poor man's Bojan Bogdanović. Yes, it would be awesome to have him coming off the bench. Yes, he would give the Jazz a dynamic they don't have, being able to go pure five out. Memo was absolutely awesome. It'd actually probably be okay in this NBA with a little bit more zone defense and the way you can play defensively. I actually think you could probably hide him a little bit better. But Donovan going back. Good question. That was fun. Another one from following along. Do you expect any draft candidates will work out in person in Salt Lake? No, I don't, other than Yoeli Childs and Sam Merrill. And that's just because that's what the NBA rules are. You're doing kind of your prospect or your draft combine stuff wherever you call home. And teams can come and watch you wherever you call home. Now, some guys move immediately after college, and Sam Merrill's done with college, and Yoeli Childs is done with college, so they may have gone home. And now Yoli's from here, so is Sam. But maybe they went to a training facility in California or working with professionals somewhere and said, hey, it's better to be in California where we have better facilities, and I'm going to do that. That's certainly possible. So they may have left. I actually don't know. I should find that out, where they're working out. And also Mitch Harper, who's our BYU insider and writer, does a ton of coverage on Yoeli as well, if you're interested in that. But those would be the guys that would be working out here. Otherwise, no, people won't be coming to Salt Lake to work out. And then, let's see, Jake on Twitter, Jake Prajanovic says, can you find a stat for career technical fouls or ejections by a coach? I assume Jerry Sloan owns the record, but I can't find it. Jerry Sloan does own the record. And there did used to be a stat that had this. I found it online before. And if I'm correct, I think Karl Malone had the second most, because I used to joke with Gordy Chiesa, who was the longtime assistant coach of the Utah Jazz, who I've done broadcasting with along my way a couple of different times. And his joke was always that he'd seen the most technical fouls in NBA history, and maybe other than Phil Johnson, who was Jerry's number one assistant. But that's probably true. I mean, Jerry had the most ever. And then behind him, I think Karl was as a player. Now, Rashid may have passed him, even though he didn't play for 19 years. Rodman got close, I think, but didn't play as long either. I have seen those numbers, and I know Jerry Sloan did have the most ever. And then when you add him in as a player, where he got a bunch, he was like so far ahead of everybody. If I can find it, I'll tweet it at you. But Jerry does have the most in NBA history. So kind of a fun stat there. That's all the questions I got. You can always tweet at me at Ben's Hoops. Appreciate you subscribing, listening to the podcast. Download the KSL Sports app once again. Follow us at kslsports.com, and we'll be back with you again next week.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.